This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be joined by Gita Gutierrez, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights who represents detainees in U.S. custody at Guantanamo Bay.
One of the real heroes of the human rights movement. She's been to Guantanamo 10 times and has done extraordinary work in trying to push back the Bush administration's torture, disappearances, and indefinite detentions.
We'll also talk with Andy Patel, one of the lawyers for Jose Padilla, who has been held in a South Carolina brig for 3 years, and only last year was granted the right to meet with his attorneys.
For more than 4 years, Andy Patel has been making an amazing effort to try and get Jose Padilla any kind of a hearing where the government has to prove why he's being kept in jail.
We'll also talk with attorney Jonathan Hafetz from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Mr. Hafetz represents Khaleh Al-Mari.
The second show is part of a four-part series describing post-9/11 detentions, torture, and excesses in the so-called War on Terror. Today, we will be focusing on detentions without trial. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Since the summer of 2004, Law and Disorder has brought Pacifica listeners the voices of activists, authors, and attorneys from the front lines. Last week, and in the next 3 weeks, we examine in a four-part series the foundation for what many view as a police state in the United States. In this series, we will talk with guests about the post-9/11 blueprint of this dictatorship, police state, and how the nefarious turn to war, the use of torture, and the domestic propagation of fear unfolded. We have examined at length topics such as torture, domestic surveillance, criminalizing dissent, racial profiling, indefinite detentions, and the destruction of constitutional rights as vital information to bring an understanding to listeners as to how it happened and where we go from here. In this second part of this four-part series, we take a look through the eyes and experiences of our guest attorneys representing enemy combatants indefinitely detained in this country and abroad. You'll hear their firsthand accounts of deplorable conditions and torture techniques implemented under the umbrella of twisted legislation. Rather than setting up a narrow intelligence-based effort to prosecute the perpetrators of a criminal action, the Bush administration exploited the tragic events of 9/11 as an excuse to cast a broad net, used to justify the demonization of all Muslims. This, as the use of CIA torture techniques, sent shockwaves rippling through the conscience of all Americans. You will get the sense of how the U.S. government has institutionalized racial profiling, detention prisons, and torture in its fervent effort to implement the so-called War on Terror. In the third part of this series, we'll look at the crackdown of dissent in this country, including how the government has set up a terrorist database to categorize and target domestic activists. As attorneys on the front lines, we bring you exclusive cases of domestic surveillance of protesters. Our final episode will be devoted to the unjust and illegal war in Iraq. We believe that taken together, the four-part series reveals how the plans for a police state and martial law are being cemented. Law and Disorder will call attention to this emergence by bringing the voices of strength and opposition from activists, authors, and attorneys who are well-informed, not silent, and standing up against the strangling of democracy.
Today we'll be speaking with Geeta Gutierrez. Geeta is an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She's been focusing heavily in the last few years on the Guantanamo detainees. She's made 10 trips to Guantanamo. She represents some well-known people in Guantanamo. El Catani, he was the man who the Time magazine gave the published log of his torture, signed off by Rumsfeld. She also represents one of the 14 men who was recently sent to Guantanamo from a secret CIA site, Majid Khan.
Welcome to Law and Disorder, Geeta.
Thank you.
If you're writing the history books 20 years from now, how would you write about Guantanamo?
I think first and foremost, it's been a moral stain on the United States, and that the history books will reflect this. As much as we're in a, or have been in a state of fear or hype that the Bush administration's perpetuated, as our country and I think the world is calming down and looking more closely at the detentions and at the men who are imprisoned, we're realizing that it's been a gross mistake and miscarriage of justice.
Among the many post-9/11 developments that we've seen, how would you describe Guantanamo?
Guantanamo is primarily a detention center that was designed for interrogations, and it was created out of secrecy and meant to be a place where men could be held beyond the law, where the Bush administration could try interrogation tactics that would not otherwise be permissible. Some of the methods of interrogation and the conditions of confinement are very common and typical among the prisoner population at Guantanamo. That's its primary purpose. And over 700 Muslim and Arab men from around the world have been held in Guantanamo at different times.
Give us some details on that. What's typical of what they do to those people there?
What's very typical in Guantanamo is to have prisoners who were held in conditions of sensory deprivation or sensory overstimulation, rooms without any lighting at all or rooms where there's 24-hour lighting. Many of them have been held in isolation for months, some of them even years. And sleep deprivation is an extremely common tactic, whether it's as a result of 20-hour interrogations or because prisoners are on what's euphemistically called the frequent flyer program, where they're moved from cell to cell. So as soon as they fall asleep, they're woken up, sometimes strip searched, and then moved to another cell. And of course, the kinds of sexual or religious humiliation is typical. And there's been, and still to this day, an extreme amount of violence at Guantanamo between the prisoners and the MPs.
You've been there 10 times, so you know this place as well as any civilian, if not much better than any civilian out there. Tell us what the world doesn't know about Guantanamo.
I think it's extremely hard to describe the impact of the isolation on the men and how incredibly restrictive the environment is. And I think fundamentally to try and convey to people who these men really are, they are not Al-Qaeda terrorists, and there have been many, many statistical analyses and reports issued that the men were picked up by mistake. But when you go and you actually meet individual after individual who has a similar story of being traded for bounty, who never engaged in hostilities against the United States, and to this day doesn't harbor, amazingly, hostility against the United States, it's also been hard to accept and to see the kinds of conditions that they're living in. The Pentagon has tried very hard to portray Guantanamo as a seaside resort where the men are being fed lemon chicken and can exercise whenever they want, and that's a delusion. At best, most of the time, the men are sitting in cement cells. They have nothing to read. They are lucky to get out once a day. They're even luckier if that happens during the daytime and not at night. They cannot communicate with one another, and it is, in many instances, destroying them psychologically.
Geeta, tell us about the cases that you've been involved in Guantanamo.
Well, the center's involved in a number of cases. We represent several hundred detainees, either directly or as co-counsel, in their petitions for writ of habeas corpus in U.S. federal courts. So the center's been involved in litigating things like trying to prevent the government from using force feeding against clients. Our attorneys go down and conduct visits with individuals in Guantanamo while their lawyers are waiting for security clearance. We also represent two individuals directly, Mohammed Al-Qahtani, a Saudi citizen who was subjected to what's called the first special interrogation plan, a regime of torture interrogation that was authorized by Secretary Rumsfeld and down through the chain of command. And then we also represent Majid Khan, who is a Pakistan citizen who had asylum in the United States, whose family lives in Baltimore. And he was held in secret CIA detention for approximately 3 years prior to showing up in Guantanamo in September of this year.
And have you met one-on-one with each of these individuals?
I've met with Mohammed Al-Qahtani a number of times. I've also met with multiple other individuals that we represent with co-counsel. The government is now blocking our access to Majid Khan, and we're currently litigating that and awaiting an order from the district court allowing us to meet with him.
Geeta, what did the interrogators do to Al-Qahtani down there? I know that there was a big deal made of him here, that he was like the 20th hijacker. What's he really like and what happened to him?
First, I want to say that the government has never come forward with those allegations anywhere other than in the mainstream press on what reason they may have to hold Mohammed. Meeting with him has been incredibly challenging and also extremely disturbing to see someone who is a victim of U.S. government torture. He is suffering both physically and mentally from his injuries from his interrogations, and was clearly not, didn't suffer from those kinds of mental injuries before he came to Guantanamo. He's very aware that he's suffering. During his interrogations, and I should also qualify that these descriptions are from U.S. government documents. They're from FOIA, Freedom of Information Act government documents. They're from statements made by interrogators. This is what I'm going to tell you is not just based on allegations from Mohammed, and that's something that's unique about his case. An interrogation log was leaked from Guantanamo that described nearly 50 days of sleep deprivation that Mohammed was subjected to. He was given 20-hour interrogations and only permitted to sleep early in the morning or the middle of the day to disrupt his mindset and his mental capabilities. He was sexually humiliated by female interrogators when male MPs held him down on the ground, pinned him to the floor, and allowed a female interrogator to straddle him and molest him. He was subjected to forced nudity. He had an enema given to him by medical professionals at Guantanamo during interrogations in front of military police and interrogators. In addition to religious humiliation, having his beard and head shaved, and all other kinds of stress positions and physical abuse that accompanied this. Prior to that interrogation log, the 3 months going into it, or prior to it, he was held in such severe isolation that an FBI deputy director who observed him actually reported up to an official in the Army a concern about prisoner mistreatment because he observed Mr. Al-Qahtani exhibiting clear signs of psychological trauma. So that's a little bit of what we know from government documents. The interrogation log ends in January 2003. We pick up again in April 2003 when Secretary Rumsfeld actually authorized a fake rendition of Mohammed, where he was drugged and hooded and goggled and placed on a plane at Guantanamo, flown around, brought back to Guantanamo and told he was in a foreign country, one that would subject him to torture. And he was held in a different part of the prison facility and denied, the Red Cross was denied access to him for several months. And these are the kinds of extraordinarily outrageous and lawless things that have happened to him. And again, that's really only very little of what occurred to him. These are the things that we can point to that are corroborated by government documents.
Now, when you meet with him, I can imagine that he is humiliated to discuss some of these things with you. Is he able to articulate some of the episodes of torture that have happened to him?
I think as with any victim of torture, there are some things that are easier for him to talk about than others. I certainly don't push him. And we leave him the opportunity to talk about the things that he's ready to speak about. As most of your listeners probably know, we are unable to take in an independent psychiatrist down to provide him any kind of treatment or even to assist us during the attorney-client interviews. That certainly would be helpful. We're not permitted to do that. Our visits are also extremely restrictive. We are meeting in the same type of cell and perhaps at times the same cell where he was held during his interrogations. It is an extraordinarily challenging experience both for him and for us as human rights attorneys.
And are you monitored when you're with him?
According to a ruling by a district court, the government is not permitted officially to monitor our conversations. There have certainly been indications in past years that there's unofficial monitoring. I think that any responsible and ethical attorney going into that kind of uncertainty needs to be aware that there may be unofficial monitoring, and certainly that's how Muhammad and I operate.
It'd certainly be surprising if they weren't doing it to you. What are your plans? What can you do for him?
We are, of course, pursuing every available avenue in U.S. federal court. Right now, there are challenges to the Military Commission Act and its purported attempt to strip the federal courts of jurisdiction over these cases. We are working with a number of cases that are on appeal right now in the D.C. Court of Appeals to challenge that law. We visit Muhammad regularly. One aspect of the representation that many people don't realize is simply helping these men retain a sense of humanity. We also engage in a great deal of international advocacy and are working close through diplomatic efforts and other international efforts to work on his behalf.
If you're unsuccessful in overturning the Military Commission Act or parts of it, what kind of trial is he going to get?
For Muhammad, in particular, I believe about a week and a half ago, the judge advocate generals and some of the officials at Guantanamo discussed the fact that he actually is unprosecutable. And by that, they were pointing to the fact that his interrogations were so beyond the law that he could never be brought into any kind of criminal proceeding, either military commission or otherwise. They argue that it would be too embarrassing to the United States. We would argue, as his attorneys, that there's been no evidence that they've obtained either from him or other individuals that wasn't obtained through torture. So for Muhammad, really, a criminal prosecution, I think, practically and legally is out of the question. He deserves a fair and independent hearing to justify his detention, and if not, should be transferred to Saudi Arabia. And that's actually true for many, many of the prisoners in Guantanamo.
Well, on that note, Geeta, let's go back to sort of the big picture of what has happened in terms of public awareness about the conditions in Guantanamo. How many prisoners are still there? Do you think in the next year or two things are going to improve?
There are about 450 prisoners still at Guantanamo. The vast majority of them have been there since early 2002. In terms of the conditions improving, I think what's difficult for many of the lawyers and certainly difficult for our clients right now is that the Guantanamo is getting whitewashed. There are people not being held in Camp X-Ray anymore. There are many media tours. The prison is trying to be accommodating to visits by attorneys. But the actual day-to-day life of these prisoners is not changing. They still sit in a cell all day long and wonder why they're in Guantanamo. Their families still cannot communicate with them. Many of them may not receive a letter from their family at all for 6 months to a year. There's no phone, there's no television, there's no radio. They're completely cut off. So I think that my concern is that the military will make Guantanamo seem like a humane prison, but at the same time, these men, their psychological state is becoming so compromised that I think many of them will have a real challenge when they get out of Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. On the long-term front, and I think politically and diplomatically, the United States is under tremendous amount of pressure from the international community to transfer citizens back to their home countries. Now, the State Department has tried to portray the problem as lying with the home countries who are unwilling to take the prisoners back under the conditions that the United States is proposing. The conditions, though, that the United States are proposing are often unlawful in these home countries. And so the countries of Kuwait or the United Kingdom are in a catch-22, where the United States is saying, we want to give you your citizens back, but we need you to either keep them in prison without charges or we need you to subject them to 24-hour surveillance. And many of the countries are saying, you know, first of all, that's against our law. We have a law in this country and we would need to give someone a fair trial in order to imprison them. Or the countries are saying, as the United Kingdom did about many of the British residents, there's no basis for subjecting them to 24-hour surveillance and to devote those kinds of resources. So we need to get the U.S. government to allow people simply to be transferred home and for the home countries to really step up to the plate and put the United States to task on some of these conditions.
Geeta, as an attorney who's one of the few who's been down to Guantanamo, how does this affect you? Does it haunt you when you come back or working on the cases?
It does. And I don't think I'm unique among the lawyers that go to the base in that respect. For any human rights worker who is going into a prison and meeting with someone who's been subjected even to the indefinite detention and isolation, which constitute torture, it's difficult. When you're going into a prison that is run by your own country and seeing individuals who are victimized by your own country's soldiers, it's extremely disturbing.
Gita knows I have tremendous admiration for her. You know, she's made 10 trips to Guantanamo. And I went down there in the early 90s when we were representing Haitian refugees. It still is the most jarring thing that I've ever done. And the idea that I would ever consider going back to Guantanamo and facing even a worse situation than I ever saw is something that I actually don't think I'm capable of doing. And the fact that you've gone there for 10 times, I just, you know, in a situation that's much, much less hopeful than we had for the refugees is just remarkable.
What's your stepping back, not just considering what they've done at Guantanamo, but what they've done from the Patriot Act up to the Military Commission Act, all that's happened in this country in the last 5 years, where do you think we're at legally, politically, in America today?
I do think we are at a turning point. After September 11th, the country was, and the legal system was understandably shocked, and I think operating from a state of fear. I think it's similar to, the analogies have been made to Pearl Harbor, and you look at the internment of Japanese Americans, something that we would normally have never considered a possibility, and then it did happen. After September 11th, I think our country was driven by fear, and we allowed the Bush administration to step through that door, and they certainly did. The policies and the practices that came out of that period of time, both, as you said, domestically and also internationally, have really expanded executive power in a way that has been unprecedented in our country. Normally, Congress and the judiciary will act as a check on all those kinds of things, wiretapping, the detention of U.S. citizens like Padilla, the detention of immigrants within the United States, the detentions in Guantanamo, the development of CIA black sites and unlawful interrogations. All of these kinds of things arose out of September 11th. I think at this point that those high emotions have calmed down, that the international community has stepped back, and where we once had many, many allies in supporting us as right after September 11th, we mostly now have countries looking at us and thinking that we are so beyond the pale and so outside the mainstream of the international community that we're really seen as a renegade state. And domestically, I believe people, both American citizens and non-citizens living in this country, are starting to seek accountability from the administration to justify the kinds of practices that have been put into place. And we're also seeing both the courts and, despite the Military Commission Act, I think the public seeking to rein in some of the abuses of executive power. I do think it's going to take perhaps generations to right the balance, but I would not expect it to get any worse in the mainstream, although there may still be legislative problems.
Gita, you also mentioned that you, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, are representing Majid Khan. Can you tell us a little about his case, how he got to Guantanamo, what his situation is?
Sure. The center began representing Majid because his wife in Pakistan actually contacted us, and he was considered a ghost detainee or someone who had been disappeared. There was substantial evidence that he was in the hands of the U.S. government somewhere in a CIA black site. And as many people know, in these CIA black sites, there are all kinds of interrogation practices being done, including waterboarding, that are not otherwise permissible. We didn't know where Majid was or had a great deal of information on him in terms of his detention. His family is also in Baltimore. They moved to the United States from Pakistan in about 1996 and sought asylum, actually, in this country. And Majid graduated from Owing Mill High School and many friends in the United States. On September 6, President Bush announced in a speech that he had transferred 14 prisoners to Guantanamo. And these were the first transfers since September 2004. Majid Khan was one of them. His family learned that he had been moved to Guantanamo not from any of the FBI agents who they'd been cooperating with for years, but from a Washington Post reporter who knocked on their door on September 6 and said, "Did you know Majid's alive and he's in Guantanamo?" And of course, the family was shocked but incredibly relieved to know that he was alive. We now know that Majid was held in a CIA facility called the Salt Pit in Afghanistan. that he was held with four other individuals who have since been either released from the salt pit or two who were released from Guantanamo. One of them is an individual named Khaled al-Masri, who submitted a declaration in support of Majid's – or our, the center's efforts to get access to Majid. And Khaled describes the conditions where they were being detained, very quite bleak, worse than in Guantanamo, and goes in great detail about Majid's efforts actually to seek to speak to U.S. authorities when he was in the salt pit and the complete denial of any rights for him.
Do we know if the salt pit is the same as a secret CIA black site or is, might be another place?
There's been, of course, no official acknowledgement from the U.S. government about what the salt pit is, but from researchers and investigators, it seems to be a CIA detention facility, a secret CIA detention facility in Bagram.
And have you been able to meet with Majid yet?
No, the military is refusing to give us access to Majid Khan and trying to say that his situation is unique because of his former custody in a CIA detention facility. They describe him as, quote, coming into possession, unquote, of classified information, which apparently is the new euphemism for he might have been tortured using CIA secret methods that we don't want him to tell his lawyer about.
Right. So they're trying to prohibit you really from seeing him until you're under an order that you can't tell people about torture. Is that right? I don't know. I'm just trying to remember.
That's a fair paraphrasing, I think, of the government's documents. They're actually arguing that the current basically gag order that lawyers have when they go down to Guantanamo is not sufficient, that there needs to be an even more restrictive one. And actually, from a legal perspective, the order that's in place governing all of the access to for lawyers to their clients in Guantanamo requires us to pass any information that is going to become public through an intelligence team of the military that determines what can be made public and what cannot. So really, it's a very irrational fear on behalf of the government. Somehow we would get access to Majid Khan, and that would turn immediately into a public disclosure of anything, really.
So right now you're awaiting a decision from a court on your access to Majid Khan. Is that right?
We are. We are. And again, they're pointing to his coming into possession of secret CIA information as the reason to delay him any access. After 3 years of being God knows where, and he's finally at a point where he's in a prison, that lawyers are able to come visit him, and he should have access to justice, and the government's continuing to deny that.
Geeta, how old is Majid?
He's in his mid-20s. Mm. He's got a very young wife in Pakistan, and he also has a beautiful 3-year-old daughter who he has never met. And we hope to be able to go down and at least bring him a picture of his daughter.
Okay, so I know you're representing a number of the Guantanamo detainees, plus Majid Khan. And then the Center for Constitutional Rights, a series of cases on behalf of Bagram detainees. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Bagram Detention Facility is a U.S. military prison in Afghanistan that, frankly, when it looked like there was going to be judicial review or some kind of court involvement in Guantanamo, the military stopped sending people from Afghanistan to Guantanamo. And I should say that many people were picked up all over the world and brought into Afghanistan before going to Guantanamo. They were not all picked up on the field in Afghanistan, battlefield. Once lawyers started coming into Guantanamo, people wound up in Bagram and they just stayed there. There's not been nearly the transparency in Bagram that we've had in Guantanamo. It's very much unknown. We don't know what processes the prisoners have been through to screen them out or release them. We don't know what their conditions of confinement are like. It's not clear what interrogation methods have been used on people in Bagram. And I believe there's reportedly somewhere around 500 prisoners in Bagram right now. The center has had attorneys go to Afghanistan and meet with families whose relatives are in U.S. custody. We initially went because of our work in Guantanamo and then started meeting with families whose relatives are in Bagram. Those family members asked us to take legal steps on behalf of their brothers and fathers and sons who were in Bagram. And prior to the passage of the Military Commission Act, the center filed a case on behalf of, I believe, 25 men who are imprisoned in Bagram. And that case is now pending in the district court. The first steps, I think, will be determining the jurisdiction of the courts over these cases and then moving forward with whether the men's legal rights, both under international and constitutional law, have been upheld.
So with all these cases from Guantanamo, Majid Khan, El-Khatani, the Bagram cases, they're all really facing this fight with the Military Commission Act. Is that right? About the stripping of habeas, really?
Yes.
Geeta, thank you so much for all your insights and for being with us once again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Today we'll be speaking with Jonathan Hafitz. Jonathan Hafitz is an attorney at the Brennan Center in New York City. He is representing El Mari, who is a non-citizen held as an enemy combatant in the United States. He's been litigating the El Mari case for some 5 years. El Mari is still in a naval brig in South Carolina.
Khaled El Mari has been held for 5 years, and currently he's being held as an enemy combatant, which means he's held without charge, in indefinite detention, without having seen his family, his friends, having access to the press, or the public.
Jonathan comes to us from the Brennan Center, but before that he was at a law firm called Gibbons Del Deo. Gibbons, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights, was one of the early firms that took on the Guantanamo cases. That's where really Jonathan got his start. Jonathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your client and his situation?
Well, he was arrested by the United States almost 5 years ago in December 2001. He came to the United States in September of 2001 with his wife and five children to study at Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. He was arrested in December of 2001, and he was charged in a prosecution 2 months later on various allegations. For the next 16 months, his case proceeded through the criminal justice system and prepared for trial. He denied the allegations and sought to demonstrate his innocence. Very shortly before trial, and while a motion was pending in court to dismiss his case, the president declared him an enemy combatant using a boilerplate form, said he was a danger to the United States, and as a result, he was stripped from the protections of the Constitution gives to people accused of wrongdoing, and he was put in a military jail in South Carolina, where he was held for 16 months without any access to his lawyers or even to the International Committee for the Red Cross, subjected to coercive interrogations, torture, and cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment.
Jonathan, hold up for 1 second. I just want to get to that prison, which is in South Carolina.
That's right, Michael.
Now, that was also the prison where they held Chaplain Yee, the man from Guantanamo, the chaplain, as I recall.
And that's where they held also Jose Padilla, who was the other enemy combatant who was seized or arrested in the United States, declared an enemy combatant. So that's correct. It's a military jail where military prisoners are held.
Well, tell us the difference between being charged criminally as he was in the beginning and then what happened to him in South Carolina. What's the difference between the criminal charges and being held as an enemy combatant?
It's really night and day. I mean, as a criminal defendant, he was incarcerated, but he had access to his lawyers, he had access to the courts, and he was going to be given a proceeding, a fair proceeding, that America has under the Bill of Rights, where the government has to put its proof on, has to put witnesses on. He has a right to cross-examine witnesses and to present evidence. And if he's convicted, he's punished. Instead, he was taken to this Alice in Wonderland world of enemy combatant, where he had no rights, no access to his lawyers, no access to the courts, no access to anything in the public, and there was no proceeding. There was no evidence that had to be put against him. No witnesses.
So really, what
no
happened
hearing.
Is one day he's sitting in either the trial court for the criminal case,
And the president says, I'm declaring an enemy combatant. And he signs a form. All of a sudden, he's taken to this prison.
Naval brig, exactly. It's by the stroke of
No attorney, nothing.
No attorney. It's by the stroke of the president's pen. You can be deprived of all your rights. Anybody at any point in the United States, any civilian, citizen, non-citizen, at home, at work, or you know, you're arrested, and instead of being charged and tried, you're put in a military brig and denied access to constitutional rights.
Let me go through the timing again. He was here for 16 months facing the criminal case.
That's correct.
And then after 16 months, he gets pulled into the military brig.
That's correct.
And how many months? He's been there for how long now?
Well, he's been there for 3 years. Well, over 3 years. In June of 2003, he was designated. He was arrested in 2001. He was designated enemy combatant in 2003. So he's been there since then.
What's his life been like for the past 3.5 years?
Well, it's been obviously very difficult. The worst period was the initial period, year and a half. He was, you know, subject to coercive interrogations. This was all done.
What does that mean, coercive interrogation?
Well, it means he was he was denied all contact with the outside world. He was threatened. Well, he was made various threats against him that he would be rendered to Egypt or Syria. His wife and children would be sent there. They would be tortured and raped. He was denied basic necessities, things that we take for granted, like toilet paper, soap. He was denied even the Quran for a period of time, denied access to other things that are fundamental to a Muslim person who wants to practice their religion. He was denied other things like hot food. Water in his cell was cut off. The lights were kept on 24 hours a day to create an environment of total deprivation.
Let me get this again. He was coming here on a visa, student visa.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's correct.
And he had been there before. He had been here. Hadn't he been here as an undergrad?
Yes, he had previously.
And what country was he from?
He's from Qatar.
From where?
Qatar.
Qatar.
Yeah.
Okay. They let him into the country and everything, and then he was here for a short while, and they arrested him. Right? Is that?
That's exactly right, Michael. He was let in. He came in, legally, like millions of other.
I think on the unhappy date of September 10th, 2001.
That's correct.
Yeah. Oh, really? Is that right? Wow.
Okay. And he was arrested in December?
In December.
Yeah.
And so I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the play. We're then going through his conditions in prison there.
Right.
He's made an enemy combatant. He's stuck in some brig. And then he has no attorney. So what happened?
October 2004, so approximately 16 months after he was kept in the brig, he had his first access to his attorney.
So, Jonathan, you said he was taken as an enemy combatant designated by the president, and he filled out essentially a form to do that, which, of course, as you said, he could do to any legal permanent resident, any undocumented person, or any citizen.
Correct.
He could do the same form. Were there any actual substantive allegations against the guy?
No, not in that form. After his court case was filed and the government finally answered after the court case about 16 months later, they filed a declaration from a Department of Defense official who had no personal knowledge or involvement in anything, just a declaration based on multiple levels of hearsay, second, third-hand statements, saying that he was, an al-Qaeda sleeper agent. He came in to conduct a wave of post-9/11 attacks. But what's striking is many of the allegations were actually contained in or based on information in the criminal indictment against al-Mari. So nothing was new. The government just decided that they did not want to try him in a criminal case, did not feel they needed to put their proof on, and possibly, declared him an enemy combatant in retaliation for his asserting his constitutional rights and at his trial, rights that everyone has.
The initial criminal charges were about credit card fraud, right?
Well, they were about credit card fraud, but there were also allegations of terrorism-related allegations in the criminal indictment. There were allegations of phone calls allegedly made from his cell phone to an al-Qaeda financier, information about material on a laptop computer that they had, which said showed al-Qaeda leanings and support for al-Qaeda. So none of this was new. In the weeks before they declared him an enemy combatant, his defense counsel, who are also his current counsel, vigorously contested the charges against him and the case against him. And the government, increasingly sought to retaliate, to impose restrictions on his ability to meet with counsel. Also, there were sort of veiled threats of decisions made by higher-ups that he might be declared an enemy combatant if he didn't cooperate or if he, insisted on pressing his rights. There seems to be at least an implication that this was done in retaliation for his asserting his rights at trial, and the government or the president just deciding that he didn't have to try him, but could just instead kind of do an end run around all the constitutional protections.
Of course, he can do that with anybody. But let me ask, he came in September 10th, 2001. He's then in this criminal case for around 16 months, a year and a half. By that time, we're into 2003 when he's put into a Navy brig. How long did it take you guys to reconnect with him as lawyers once he's in the military brig? Because then at that point, they said, we have no more right, even though you saw him before in the criminal case, you have no right to be his lawyer anymore. He has no lawyer. How did you get to be his lawyer again, and how long did it take?
Well, it took about 16 months until October of 2004, after the Supreme Court's decisions in the Rasul versus Bush case involving Guantanamo detainees and the Hamdi case, which involved a U.S. citizen, a guy named Hamdi, who was actually kept at the brig with Almari. He was the third enemy combatant there. And after that, the government essentially allowed, court ordered us to be able to meet with Almari. So I guess it was about 16 months that he was kept without
counsel. Quite remarkable.
Counsel.
So here's this guy for 16, for the first year and a half, he has a criminal case, he has you guys as his lawyers, he has all kinds of constitutional rights. Boom, the president signed something. He's alone completely in a Navy brig undergoing coercive interrogations for another year and a half before he went in the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right.
And the world knows more about his case than he does.
Oh, absolutely. He did not know anything. I mean, you know, at that point about what was happening in court or anything.
I know Jose Padilla was tortured in various ways, including sensory deprivation, so that he would have a mental breakdown, sleep deprivation, temperature changes. What was the situation with Almari?
Oh, exactly the same. I mean, if not worse. You know, all those allegations that have been made in Almari's case. He has a separate lawsuit. One lawsuit that we've been talking about challenging his detention and the right of the president to declare him an enemy combatant and snatch him from the protections of the criminal justice system. But there's a separate lawsuit challenging his conditions of confinement, which remain quite severe, and challenging all those coercive interrogation techniques, sensory deprivations that you mentioned and that Padilla was subjected to. And the response of the government has been not to deny that happened, but to say that he has no right to come into court to challenge his conditions of confinement or interrogation because the president has declared him an enemy combatant and the United States is immune from any kind of suit.
And, of course, that's very similar to what happened to, I know you also represented Guantanamo detainees as well or worked on those cases, very similar to the kinds of coercive interrogations, torture, whatever you would like to term it, that happened at Guantanamo.
Very similar.
And all authorized by Rumsfeld going down the line, as far as we know.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the Almari's designation was an enemy combatant came shortly after many of the techniques, these coercive techniques, were approved by Rumsfeld and others.
Right. They were approved in December 2002, as I recall, so with those 12 or 15 techniques. So it must have happened right around then.
And the April working group report,
right.
So shortly after that. So they decided to, you know, use these on individuals in the United States.
Jonathan, would you consider these coercive techniques really torture?
Oh, I certainly would. I think that, they individual techniques and put together the type of sensory deprivation he was exposed to, the threats to, you know, his life and safety and to that of his family, certainly amount to torture, at a minimum, cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment. But they are certainly, whatever label you call them, you know, they are clearly against American values and violate the Constitution.
Could you discuss the nature of your attorney-client relationship?
We were denied access to Mr. Almari for 16 months, so that was very difficult not to be able to see or talk to your client for, you know, almost a year and a half. But since then, you know, we've had access to him. We're able to speak with him and meet with him. You know, we have a very positive, you know, attorney-client, you know, relationship. He has a sense of what's being done, and if the United States doesn't, he understands that it's contrary to everything the United States stands for, and is hoping that, you know, justice will be done and that the rule of law will be followed.
Litigation-wise, where are you guys right now with his case? Is he any chance of getting a serious hearing, a trial? What's going on with
him? Well, his case was dismissed by the district court, which said the president had the authority to hold him as an enemy combatant indefinitely, and that all the government would have to submit to support this would be this single hearsay declaration. There'd be no evidence, no hearing, no witnesses, and they could hold him forever based on that. We've now appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
There's two lawyers who are doing a huge amount of work on these cases, Jonathan Heifetz and
from who's now at the Brennan Center, and Gita Gutierrez, who's at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And they both came out of Gibbons Del Deo, right, where they've been working for 2 years on Guantanamo. And, of course, your the chief there, Judge Gibbons, argued the Razul case in 2004.
Right.
So thank you, Jonathan.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. Thank you.
Good job.
On September 9th, the United States Court of Appeals decided the case of Jose Padilla, in which it reversed the granting of habeas corpus by U.S. District Court Judge Henry Floyd of South Carolina. When Jose Padilla was arrested in 2002, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced, from Moscow, ironically, that in capturing Padilla, the government had intercepted an alleged dirty bomb plot against the U.S. by al-Qaeda. President Bush declared Padilla an enemy combatant, placed him in the custody of the military, and in detention in a brig in South Carolina, all without charge, trial, or access to his own counsel. After 2 years in confinement, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take review of an earlier habeas corpus petition. Born in Brooklyn, Mr. Padilla remains the first and only American picked up on American soil and held as a purported enemy combatant. After the Supreme Court ruled in favor of another enemy combatant, Yasser Hamdi, Padilla was transferred into criminal custody. We're delighted to welcome once again to Law and Disorder Andrew Patel, one of Mr. Padilla's attorneys. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Andrew.
Andy, tell us about your case. You had one of the infamous enemy combatants in the United States, one of the three. Can you tell us a little bit about your client?
Sure. I did and do represent Jose Padilla. Mr. Padilla was initially arrested in Chicago by agents of the FBI on a material witness warrant that had been issued by a district court judge here in New York. He was brought to New York. He was assigned counsel who moved to have him released.
And now, as I recall, Andy, he was got off a plane in Chicago. He's a U.S. citizen, was arrested right then. Is that right?
That's essentially correct, yes.
Okay. And then you got, as you said, he was eventually brought here.
Right. He is a U.S. citizen, and he was on a flight from Zurich to Chicago, where he has family. He's a son who lives in Chicago. On June 9th, which was a Sunday, the President of the United States signed an order.
What year?
2002, unlike any order that's been signed by any previous President of the United States, ordering Mr. Padilla's transfer from civilian custody to the custody of the Department of Defense. And he was immediately transferred to Department of Defense personnel and transported to the brig in Charleston, South Carolina, that I believe Mr. Hafitz spoke or will speak about.
That's the same brig where Al-Mari is being kept and where Chaplain Yee was kept, and other sort of domestic enemy combatants.
Where Mr. Hamdi was also kept.
That's right.
Yes.
And so what happened after that? Did he have a lawyer at that point? What happened?
Well, he certainly did, although he didn't know it. He was held in the brig. There was a writ of habeas corpus was filed on his behalf initially in New York. It went up through the district court judge. There were a number of opinions issued by then Chief Judge Mukasey. There was an appeal to the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit found that the president did not have the authority to order the military detention of an American citizen. The government appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and they specifically asked the court to take only two issues, the issue of jurisdiction, that is, should the court in New York have heard this, or should the court in South Carolina have heard this, and the issue of presidential authority, that is, did the president have the authority to do this? We asked the court, since we had won in the Second Circuit, to leave well enough alone. The Second Circuit got it right. But if you were going to take it, that they should take the due process issue, that is, Mr. Padilla's right to have access to his counsel. That issue got resolved in a rather unusual way. This case came rather late in the term, and the Supreme Court terms are rather tightly scheduled. And so we had worked out a schedule with the government as to when all the pleadings would be done. And on the cert issues, that is, first you apply to have the Supreme Court take it, and there's a petition, a response, and a reply. Those were all highly scheduled. And the government's reply brief, that is the last thing on the should they take cert, was due, I think it was February 11th, but I know that it was due at 3 o'clock.
This is 2004.
Yes. And at 1 o'clock, I'm sitting in my office. I get a call from a lieutenant colonel, whose last name I don't recall, Joint Forces Command, saying that it had been determined that Mr. Padilla would get access to us and that I should call a captain at Joint Forces Command, a captain in the Navy, so the equivalent of a full colonel, rather high-ranking officer, and make arrangements to do this. At 3 o'clock, the government filed their brief, and they said to the court, you don't have to take this due process issue of whether Mr. Padilla has access to his counsel, because that issue is now moot. And they cited to the web transcript of the Department of Defense press conference announcing that he would get access to his lawyers that it occurred at 2 o'clock. So, I mean, ink was not yet wet on that transcript when they filed this with the court.
So they didn't want that issue going to the Supreme Court,
obviously. They did not want
that
issue going to the court.
So the Supreme Court says you guys filed in the wrong court. You go back to South Carolina.
We go to South Carolina to the Honorable Henry Floyd.
And you file again.
We file a new writ. And the only difference between the writ, the first writ and the second writ, the primary difference is Mr. Padilla was able to sign this writ on his own. The first one had to be signed on his behalf. We had a hearing before Judge Floyd, who wrote an absolutely magnificent opinion in defense of the right to habeas corpus and the limits of the power of the presidency.
What did he say?
He said that the president does not have the authority to do this, that Congress can, in times of invasion or unrest, suspend the right to habeas corpus, but they had not done so. And absent that, Mr. Padilla could be charged in civil court, but he could not be detained by the military. It was really rather
good
elegant and elegantly written.
So what happens next? The government goes to the famous
Fourth Circuit, which is where they'd been trying to get all along.
Tell us why they wanted to be in the Fourth Circuit.
The Fourth Circuit is generally regarded as being one of the more conservative courts in the country. And since Mr. Padilla had already received some of the relief that he was seeking, that is, being transferred from military custody to have his day in court, in civilian court, that the court would exercise restraint and not take it. But the court then went on to say, or Justice Kennedy went on to say, and this opinion was joined by two other justices, including brand new Chief Justice Roberts, to say that if his situation should change, that he would expect that, one, a writ could be filed directly with the court, something that we had clearly already known about, and that he expected that Mr. Padilla would receive all of the rights that any American charged with a crime would receive. And I'm pleased to say that certainly as things have been going in Florida to date, that's been exactly what's been happening.
Okay, now I know you guys recently filed a motion on the conditions under which he was held. Do you want to talk about that for a moment or refers to that?
Other than saying what it is and that it's available on the court website, just go and look at PACER and go to the Southern District of Florida and search for United States versus Padilla. You can find it. You can read it. And it is what it is.
I've read some of it, Andy, and it truly is shocking the conditions under which this man was kept for years and years. Sensory deprivation to intentionally break him down emotionally and psychologically. No lights, and then all of a sudden, two bright lights. When he fell asleep, they'd wake him up. They'd kept him awake and awake and awake for day after day. Stress positions, temperature, I think. It was the kind of thing that was not only repulsive to any kind of justice system, but then to think that he had no chance of getting out of it. With fine lawyers like yourself going to the Supreme Court and not even getting any help there, an American citizen picked up, tortured, and then that main charge against him, the dirty bomb charge, which scared the pants off everybody living in America that heard of it, and then that charge at the last minute being dropped. That was the kind of manipulation of the justice system by the executive branch. Has nothing to do with the traditions of American democracy. It was really a chilling thing to read.
John Ashcroft, then the Attorney General, woke up at midnight in Moscow, where he was for, I don't know why, but that's where he was, to announce Mr. Padilla's transfer to military custody and that they had prevented this terrorist attack, the dirty bomb business. He has never been charged with that. The count of the indictment that was dismissed had nothing to do with that. The government has never, ever indicated that they would ever come forward and attempt to prove that in court. That was never a count in the indictment.
Andy Patel, attorney for Jose Padilla, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Not the only one. Wow. Maybe it's the music. Maybe it's the rhythm. You know what it is.
Here goes one more time.
He don't know law, don't the fool, I know. He don't know law, don't the baby, I know. He don't know law, don't the fool, I know. One more time, all of us, for this time with the whole band. It's a beautiful thing. Let's go, everybody, now. Let's go. Come on. Now, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thank you.